Tom, how does this microphone sound to you?
Good. No, you're coming through good. And
I'll stick with it.
Yeah, there you go. What, you just have like a ton of backup mics right behind you ready to go? Okay, well, how about this one?
You're listening to the Music Manumit podcast for November 3rd, 2013. Learn more at musicmanumit.com.
Hi, and welcome to another Music Manumit. I am Tom, and joining me is Doug. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Tom.
That was very, it was very no nonsense what I just did there. Hi, Doug. You know, I felt like I almost should have saluted when I did it with a very halting way of talking.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's this is how you're going to be, huh?
Well, I did want to say something before we bring the guest on. I just want to say very quickly that November, it won't be the entire month, but the first three interviews, assuming that everyone shows up and we have power every time, which, as we discussed last week, is occasionally a problem. We're going to be doing different things. We're going to have guests and... But the guests are all going to have things that we've not had on the show before. So, so we'll let Jason, I guess, tell the people what he does. And then
Jason being our guest.
Yeah. People can figure out why I said that it's the first time we've had a person like Jason on the show.
Well, there are probably a lot of reasons why that might be the case, but I'll stick with the professional one. Hello, I'm Jason Weinberger. Thanks for having me on, guys. And Doug, in relationship to what you said, I am an orchestra conductor, involved mainly in orchestra music, but occasionally doing some other types of stuff. And I guess we have bumped into one another online, and you had some interest in the things I've done there. So that's, I believe, why I'm on the show with you guys.
And you also, I'm assuming that you also must release your stuff under Creative Commons of some sort.
Well, yeah, I think that's our point of contact is all the material that I have out there of my own performances and also the work I do with the orchestra I direct in Iowa, WCF Symphony. Mm-hmm. We release everything we do under a Creative Commons license, whether it's video or audio. Yeah.
The whole symphony does. The whole symphony releases under Creative Commons.
Well, you know, we as an ensemble do so. I think there's a mixed bag among musicians in general.
Right.
And that's one of the interesting things about orchestras. You may have people who might not personally do that with their own work, and certainly people who do. But we sort of, as a group, make that decision generally, you know, in terms of what's best for the organization. And it's a perfect time for me to be on with you guys because we're in the midst of sort of recrafting our whole media agreement and approach with our players and our administrative side. So this is a cool time for us. We're looking at a lot of the same issues that I'm sure you're going to bring up.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we have brought this up before about symphonies and stuff and about how there are probably different ways to go about it as to like with bands, you know, you just assume like, oh, they said want to release under Creative Commons and everybody goes, yeah, sure, why not? And with symphonies, you know, I mean, there's, I don't know why, but it's always pictured or we've had discussions where it just seems like it's got to be much more difficult. And I don't know if it's because of the amount of people, like, I don't know how large your symphony is or if it, you know, variates from performance to performance. Yeah, just how would you get all those people to get on board? Like, are they, you know, there's the Musicians Guild, or I mean, are they members? Are they paid members? Do you guys get just paid by performances? I just asked a bunch of questions. Sorry about that.
I got a bunch of answers. So
oh, good, good.
Good luck. Well, no, I think you're actually asking all the right questions, especially for folks who may not know that much about how orchestras work, and particularly in this area when you're looking at rights and things like that. And it is a pretty complex and layered situation. I mean, before you even get down to that group of 60 or 70 people, you have to kind of go through what's happening with the composers and publishers, and that all precedes the process of the performance. And It's one of the things I'm sure we'll get to when we talk about public domain versus copyright material when you're looking at orchestra music. But once you get through that, then you're more in the discussion with with instrumentalists and other musicians. And I think generally speaking, when an orchestra is a unionized group, if there's a collective bargaining agreement, it can be much, much harder to work these things through. Although in recent years, you've seen a lot of those agreements really start to open up in terms of their treatment of media, and that's a good thing. Yeah. And when it's not a group that's represented through a collective bargaining agreement, then really it's an ongoing discussion, constant discussion between the administrative leadership and the artistic leadership and the musicians, revisiting that, you know, the sort of same topics as regularly as you can to make sure everybody's on board. And you'll naturally have some disagreement, but I think that communication is critical. Constantly looking at what the agreement was a year ago and 5 years ago and thinking about where things are moving. It actually is a little more flexible than those groups where musicians are represented through a union, because in that case, you know, you're sitting down once every 5 years or whatever and having a discussion there, unless you're very proactive. So we're a non-union group, and that means we have a kind of an agreement with our musicians every year that we look at. And as I mentioned, we're right in the heart of rethinking that whole agreement and really digging into it. So it's been a cool process.
And by like any indication as to how you're rethinking it, I mean, is it going to be, and this is just me being ignorant in the whole thing, but I mean, is it going to be like a cooperative, or, you know, like how would you go about rethinking it as opposed to the way it's normally done? I guess the reason I ask is again, with the ignorance on my side, like when they perform, you know, on albums that bands do, a lot of the, you know, that you'll get labeled as like, oh, you know, who's what's this on guitar and thingamajig on bass. And with a symphony, that doesn't necessarily happen because, like before you said, 60 people. So do you have to compensate them because of that in a different way? Or, you know, like what kind of restructuring are you looking at?
So actually, maybe we should step back just a step so people can get a fuller picture as far as like whether or not the symphony is full time, because a lot of people may be familiar with like community symphonies where they're not full time. So maybe just to get
I guess that's kind of what I'm asking.
Help.
Right.
And yeah, no, that's a great point. And I think both of those questions kind of dovetail. We're not a 52 week orchestra, as they call the full time groups. In other words, we are, we're performing a certain number of times a month, but it's not the only, or in some cases even the primary job for many of the musicians in the orchestra. And that would be typical of, I don't know, 80% of the orchestras in the country, or 90 if you leave out the collegiate groups.
Yeah. So just so you know, I may have told you this, but my father is actually a symphonic band director at a university. So I have some familiarity with that side of thing, but that's why I wanted to make the distinction, because this is very different than that.
And I've heard classical music. Yeah. That is my
extension. Then you are qualified. and you know, I mean, just following on that discussion there too, you've got a complex situation when you sit down to discuss any contractual agreement or any informal agreement that you have with people. It gets particularly complex when you're looking at what we do in the classical music business in the context of sort of the larger recording industry and the media industry in general, where I think there's pretty broad agreement that classical music doesn't really sell. And there are certainly certain types of recordings that have become big. And you could sort of apply the typical logic that you might apply when you discuss media rights to those things, because they resemble popular music a little bit more. But most of what orchestras do is really on the performance side, and recordings have never really been a big income creator in the business, in the strictly symphonic orchestra business. You know, let's leave out studio orchestras and stuff like that. That I think that's a little bit of a different deal. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's kind of a, when we're talking about people's work and their livelihood, for the most part, orchestras like WCF Symphony and almost all the orchestras in the country, the primary activity is performing, and secondary, if any secondary activity exists, might be recording. So there's kind of a whole different value we're talking about when at orchestras, when we talk about performance recordings. It's just, it's a little bit different, I think, than what you see in a lot of other spots in the industry. Not that there aren't some connections, but you know, I think that's one of the features of the conversation that folks may not quite be aware of.
And I was looking at some of your stuff on SoundCloud before, speaking of the, you know, like the different types of classical music and stuff that you can put out there. One, I want to make note, and this is just going to be an obscure tangent. The first thing that was on your SoundCloud page was a Mahler piece. And the only reason I know who Mahler is because of the 1990 film Reuben and Ed. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am. I am familiar with that reference.
Okay, so that's the only reason why I knew who Mahler was. Because
it's pretty heavy.
Yeah, for those who don't know, it's Crispin Glover in a, I'm doing quotes here, comedy. It's just a bizarre-ass film. And he liked to listen to Mahler with his cat.
Yeah,
in his room. So, and then his cat dies, and he goes to bury him, and that's the entire concept of the film. There you go. Spoiler alert. It's been like 30 years.
I don't have a cat.
A little late for the spoiler.
Yeah, I know. But for those of you that do know about Crispin Glover, it's also the same time period when he supposedly kicked David Letterman in the head on the Late Show because he was in character.
We're going into territory I didn't think we'd be discussing at all.
That'll happen. And then
whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, we'll leave to you to
right.
Steer.
That's all I got on that one. But the other thing too, now this is another thing we brought up as well. So now the choices of music that you can play, and Doug, I know I'm vaguely remembering the way we put this, but I know we've discussed the concept of being able to put classical music under Creative Commons that already exists or it has been, you know, it been played by many, many, many people.
Yeah, it comes up from time to time.
Yeah.
For sure.
So the whole thing that, like, the Mahler piece that's on there, it is under Creative Commons. Now, what's the, if is it under public domain and then you put it under Creative Commons, or I guess what's the how does that work?
Yeah, the music itself, and this is where you get into that question of copyright with performance music like we do at orchestras or chamber musicians do, you know, where we're doing a lot of music composed by someone else for the second, third, and fourth, fifth time, you know, hundredth, thousandth time. It's a little different than, say, a band writing some songs and playing them themselves.
Right.
Maybe a little more akin to a band doing covers, but kind of imagine what we're really doing, all covers, essentially. And so, you know, most music before a certain date in the 1920s is in the public domain. And so it's the performance itself that's at question when you're looking at Creative Commons, or if it's been a commercial recording and there's rights associated with that recording. Mm-hmm. That would be the recorded media itself. And this is actually where classical music and some of the other disciplines can diverge, I think, a little bit, because the act of recording the thing in itself is sort of like a second level action after the initial question of, you know, when was the music written, and is it in the public domain or is it copyright, or you know, when you start getting in the 20th century, there's some really complex international copyright laws that come into play with composers like Stravinsky, and so it can be very murky at that level. But once that's clarified, then you also get into this sort of question of the performance right or the recording, the recording agreement itself and whatever that was. And you know what we're trying to do, for example, is move in the direction of if it's public domain piece, we basically want to get the recording out there, our recording out there, licensed under Creative Commons, and people can use that in ways that they see fit. And I think we'd like to get to doing that with everything we can. In other words, everything we play that's in the public domain. Music that's not in the public domain by law is a different question. Sometimes composers will want us to get their work out there, and they'll say, hey, put it out there. And other times you play music by Stravinsky or a Copland, something like that. It's under copyright. You're not going to have a chance to put your recording out there, no matter what you think of it, because it's the rights holder who's going to determine that. So that's, you know, we that's where we're working in that area, and those are the decisions that are being made about, you know, to license this in such a way. It's the recorded media generally, but we look at that question of copyright before we get to that point.
And going into, you were saying, you know, choose whether to pick a song that might be in the public domain or ask to perform. How, I wondered this back when I was in high school.
I'm gonna clarify this, Tom, so Jason doesn't feel like he should do this. But it's not a song if there's no lyrics.
Oh, well, yeah, there are some exceptions to that rule. I think there are some.
Okay. All right. How's it a song if it doesn't have lyrics? I'm curious.
You know, I think that you have some of the tradition of the song form. Really, it really pours over into instrumental music more than you might think. And so you go through all symphonic music, you come across songs that are just like wordless songs, but they're in song forms, you know, for sure. But your point is also well taken. Pieces, maybe.
So isn't a
melody that word a lot?
That was what I was going to ask. I mean, would I technically call it pieces? It wasn't what I was going to ask. Yeah. It was what I was going to ask now. Thanks, Doug.
wait, where were we?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, isn't a melody considered a song? Like if a song is an instrumental, it's not a song?
Well, you know, it's probably a valid question to ask because in the era we live in now where sampling is, you know, maybe the most important musical technique out there.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd break it down to the level of just a snippet of sound. But I think, you know, what Doug was saying and what's interesting sometimes about classical music is you have this variety of forms and people say, okay, you have to say it's a piece or it's a symphony or,
right.
Or if it had a singer, you know, and lyrics, it would be a song. But there's so much crossover between those genres. And it's actually one of the things I think is an interesting model from classical music is to see over time how all those genres have mixed together. And we really have a much more stratified kind of set of genres now. And it kind of rubs you wrong if someone says, hey, the symphony played a song tonight. Right?
Yeah.
But if you go back sort of through history, I think in orchestral music, you'll find all kinds of forms mingling together, you know.
So I guess that's true that, I mean, a symphony could accompany a singer. I mean, that could easily happen. I was just thinking of...
That whole classical-backed, like, Metallica album that was out a few years ago?
Yeah, no. So I was... You know, so to the extent that I suggested...
Pretty sure those were songs.
Yeah, to the extent that I suggested that anything with singing was not a song, I did not mean to do that.
But so, it is what
but
you
that's
did.
That's actually... I don't think that's what I did, but I did want to say, actually, I mean, this is like right on point. I mean, I was going to ask this. You have pictures up on your Flickr, which all the pictures are under Creative Commons as well, or at least the ones that I looked at, of people with guitars, not, you know, traditional. Well, I guess you could play like classical guitar, but these don't look like they're classical guitarists. I mean, there's an electric guitar.
They look like ruffians.
Maybe that's
how they get
are.
In here.
So how does it work with you know, are you able to do any of the Creative Commons stuff when you have guest musicians, or does that sort of mess up the situation with, I mean, I guess the stuff they're doing may or may not be in the public domain?
Yeah, it depends. It really depends on what it is that they're doing. You know, one of the things I do outside of my regular work with the orchestra here in Iowa is conduct a symphonic show with Brandi Carlile, who's, I think, the artist who you saw in some of those photos. And her guitarists are these twin brothers, Tim and Phil Hanseroth. And we do this show all over the place. And, you know, she's records for Sony. So, I mean, you know, what she does is Creative Commons, there's not a lot of crossover there in terms of the music that we're doing. But it can range across the board in terms of what artists are interested in or willing to do. And my observation is that for the most part, younger classical musicians. So I'll admit it here. I'm getting close to 40, so I'm kind of now starting to get oldish. And the generation of classical musicians who are behind me, let's say by about a 10-year gap. We've worked with a lot of them here, and I'm interested in some of the stuff that they're doing. And that the attitude among that group and that generation is generally quite different than it is among my generation and the older generation than me in terms of kind of what it means to interact with an audience. And I think Creative Commons is very much a part of that. You know, it's there's a huge element for us as classical musicians that we're performing live, and that's kind of what we do. But there's also a recognition that people are experiencing music in very different ways. And some of that is capturing it and sharing it themselves. And other pieces of that are, you know, being able to access recorded media, for example, try and remix something or set their video to this music. That's something that for an older generation of classical musician, it's kind of hard to grasp why anybody would be interested in that. Isn't it just all about coming to hear the amazing symphony play mm-hmm. Beethoven 5, you know? But a lot of these younger musicians are much more keyed into that. And so there isn't the same hang up and the same difficulty with saying, let's recognize the value in getting this out there so that people can experience it and use it. And, you know, in a way, I think we're kind of coming around a little bit more to truly honoring what classical music is about, which is really about one generation to the next, this constant sharing and kind of almost taking and improving and adjusting. And, you know, like classical music has been remixing itself for 400 years, but we kind of ossified into this really stiff model in the 20th century. And now I really think it's loosening up the way younger musicians approach everything that we're talking about.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, some of the stuff that you have, like we just spoke about Mahler, that's not like some guy from like the 70s going, you're playing my music. You know, it's something that you build upon. Plus, being a conductor, everybody has their own interpretation of it.
Every group is going to be different, and that's I don't know, that maybe even is a better point to put across, that one of the great things about performance media is you're not trying to go in there and make some kind of, you know, like ur recording, like the ultimate version of this Mahler symphony. What you're trying to do is have that moment of that performance really be meaningful for the people in the audience. And so the more we share the recorded media from those experiences, the more people I think will begin to understand that actually, you know, an orchestra is not quite as sort of stiff and regular seeming as it looks, but it's actually quite dynamic. But we've kind of walled ourselves off from the public that way. So that's where a lot of this effort, this Creative Commons stuff, comes from, really just eliminating that wall and really encouraging people to interact with what we do.
Well, and getting back to what I was originally going to say before Doug so rudely interrupted me.
Yeah, Doug.
when you do perform, and this I wonder from like high school band, how do you come up with like, okay, this is what we're going to play? I mean, a band plays a show and they're like, how much time do we have? 45 minutes? Okay, what do we feel like playing, or what's the room going to be like? You know, that sort of thing. And you put together a set list. Now, you can't just willy-nilly go, hey, everybody here, we're going to play this, right? I mean, you have to come up with songs that you're going to learn over a period of time, and then you're going to perform for a period of time, many times probably. How do conductors, or is the conductor even the one that goes, these are the songs we're going to play this time?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And actually, I think it's one of the things that people don't realize about the way orchestras work and kind of what conductors do. You know, there was always that joke, you know, do you need the conductor up there? You know, do they really need the guy waving his arms around?
Right.
In reality, that's kind of one of the smaller pieces of the job in a way. And one of the big pieces, it's almost invisible to the general public, is the programmatic aspect, the programming of the concerts, which goes beyond just sort of, hey, we have a concert, let's put some music on it. But it goes into, you know, what's the artistic identity of the ensemble? What are you hoping to do with this audience, you know, and what are you trying to engage them in? And then even more than that, a lot of times the music you choose has a big effect on your player's experience. And that's, you know, that's a big difference sometimes from what a band might do. I mean, you know, a band is getting together and they're kind of almost stylistically in lockstep, you know, and they're sort of working towards that sort of common, you know, we all know what we're here for. You know, it's not like I want to play metal and you want to play folk music. I mean, we're here to do the same kind of thing. Whereas, you know, there's a ton of music out there for orchestras to play across just an insane range of styles.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have to think about the impact that has on the musicians as well when you send that music out. And you also bring up just the timelines. I mean, just to get music out to an orchestra so that the players have it to practice it before the rehearsals begin, and, you know, backing up from there into the various steps that have to take place. before the music goes out, it has to be marked if there are markings to put in. And a specific example of that would be bowings for the strings, so that the strings are bowing together. You back up from there to get the music from the publisher or to purchase the music. So it's really complex, the whole process of choosing music. What are your goals? What are you trying to do? What's the mix of stuff your players are involved in? And then the execution of that, getting the music, getting it prepared, getting it out to people. It's really hidden to people, but that's a huge piece of what kind of orchestras actually do to get into concerts. And, you know, you guys are having me on. And in a lot of my work here in Iowa and elsewhere, we really tried to move away from what orchestras had done for so long, which was just the same format, every concert opener, overture, followed by a concerto of some kind with a soloist, intermission, and then a symphony. And that was the orchestra concert for 75 years, and no deviation. So a lot of the programming we do now, while we're looking across styles, a big part of it is, what's the experience of the concert like for the audience, and how can we mix that up? So, for example, instead of that selection of a short, medium length, and then long length piece, we might do an evening where we have four or five medium or short length pieces and put them together in a different way. And so, you know, it's a great question you asked, because there's just so much there to talk about and so much there that you have to do as a conductor or artistic director. And unfortunately, in the business, it's not talked about enough and it's not taught enough. So I'm always out there soapboxing it, you know, like, hey, people, we gotta talk about this more. We have to teach conductors about this. And maybe that'll happen, hopefully.
Well, and when you said before about they wonder, or the old adage is, do we even need a conductor? I'm sure that when people say that to you, you show them that old Bugs Bunny cartoon with the conductor, right? Like, I mean, exactly. The amount of power that guy has just waving a hand, and it affects everything.
Well, we like to think that's the case. But, you know, most musicians, they feel the opposite may be the case. So that is a good piece of evidence, though.
Yeah, I see, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. And then also, what about things like, do you ever delve into, experimental symphonies? Like, I've seen, John Zorn's, act that he's done where he actually, performs with, I don't know if it's necessarily an orchestra, but I mean, he does an ensemble sort of thing with classical instruments, where sometimes it'll be very experimental and other times it'll be like very straight laced, more jazz like, but, I mean, do you ever experiment in that sort of realm?
Yeah, you know, John Zorn's a great example to bring up, too, there, because that's somebody who a lot of us in classical music really revere, you know, I mean, just for being such an incredible musician and also a pioneering spirit, you know, and real groundbreaking personality sort of in the whole ensemble music scene. And it's interesting that you bring him up from the perspective that you can get John Zorn into a situation with a normal symphony orchestra, and it can be really rewarding. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times there are some technical challenges just to making that happen. I mean, he's out there enough that unless the orchestra is doing a lot of really more experimental stuff, and there are some groups that are devoted to that, it can be difficult for the players to actually adapt, you know, to go from Mozart or Beethoven and then be able to execute technically what's called for by someone like John Zorn. But I think that's actually a big responsibility for orchestras going forward in the future, is to say, hey, all this stuff is part of ensemble music. And even though it's not written for an ensemble that looks exactly like ours with 30 violins and 10 violas and whatever, and go down the list, it's still very much part of our canon and our tradition. So we have to like build in ways to learn those techniques and to make sure that as orchestras mature going forward, the next generation of orchestras and two generations down the road, that playing John Zorn is kind of like a similar thing to playing Mozart. You know the style, you know the period, you know where the composer was coming from. So I think it is, your question is, you know, do we do that kind of stuff? Mm-hmm. As much as possible, seek it out. And, you know, there are practical limits here and there to what you can do. But I think there's some really fertile ground there that hasn't been explored yet. And one of the positives of it ultimately is going to be that I find in a lot of cases you work maybe a little more on the bleeding edge there. You're going to have people who are going to want to say, let's get this out there. You know, let's see what other people might do with this work.
Oh yeah.
And that's a benefit too.
And the other thing is you're also going to freak out the squares, man.
Totally.
Sorry, I just wanted to say that. I don't know why.
You know, you guys would be surprised though. It's how much, I think this is a little symptomatic of jazz and classical musicians, that, hey, you know, people like what they like, you know, and they don't want to be challenged too much. But my experience working here in Iowa for the last 9 or 10 years is the audience here really appreciates being challenged. I mean, I think they know they're going to hear something new and different. And they also know they're going to hear interesting takes on stuff that is more familiar, but they've really been so receptive. And I think there's, generally speaking, a view among orchestra people that, oh man, if we do that stuff, just no one's going to want to listen to it. And I think that is just so misguided. And, you know, there are plenty of places that have proved that's not the case.
That's true.
So you mentioned the audience in Iowa. How much of the selection has to do with where you are? Do you pick potentially like composers from Iowa, or is that part of it?
Oh, I think you do. I definitely try to find local connections almost, I think, no matter where you work. And if you're not doing that, then something's wrong. You know, I mean, that should be the organic, natural way you do things, is work with people around you. And then you reach out, you know, when it's appropriate, and bring people in who are going to bring something unique into the mix. So yeah, we definitely do that here. And we think there's a lot of interesting stuff to sort of get into, to share about the arts in Iowa that people aren't that aware of. So one of the things in our goal really with getting media out there is to try and take some of those kinds of things, which are, we feel like, hey, these are things that represent us really well. They're from our community or from our region. And get those out there more broadly, so that people aren't just, you know, becoming more exposed to music, but also maybe just culturally, like, hey, that's in Iowa. Look what they're doing there. That's interesting. I, you know, hadn't heard that before. So, yeah, definitely is a big feature of what we do. And I've enjoyed it. I've been really surprised by how many very cool artists there are around here in the cornfields.
Yeah, when it comes to things like sports, they always get people from other states and stuff to come in and play on your teams.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was just thinking that as you're saying it, because you were kind of like saying that would be really sad if we couldn't find, you know, able musicians that could do this stuff. And I was like, yeah, but like, I don't think anybody like on the Green Bay Packers here in town, in my state, are actually from Wisconsin. But anyway, I don't want to go off on a whole sports thing because I don't care. It was just something that popped into my head.
it was there.
Yeah. Did you have another question, Doug?
Well, yeah, I two presumably quick questions, but maybe not. The first one is whether or not you've ever thought of streaming live shows. And the other one was just to go back to the marking on the sheet music. And I'm just curious. I'm sure Tom doesn't care, but
I might.
You might. Do the publishers give you a license to do that? Or, I mean, it's implied. I mean, I don't think any court would say that orchestras can't do that, because that's what orchestras do. But I'm sort of curious if actually give you the permission to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, so two pieces of this, I guess, and the first one being publishers. You have a mix of stuff. You know, you guys may be familiar with IMSLP, which is I think stands for the International Music. Let's see, International Music Score Library Project. I think that's what the thing stands for. But it's an incredible repository of online PDF scores and parts to most music now, prior to most, you know, music that's been published prior to 1920s, and some from after. So, with that out there, you know, you can go to that resource, and there's no publisher involved. I mean, you just do whatever you want with the music. You can rearrange it if you want. You can play with 50 trombones instead of an orchestra, and there's no restriction at all there. But some of that music has been edited over the years, and in fact edited badly. The notorious period is the early 1800s, where most of the first editions of all this really important music were just straight up crappy and full of errors, and there was no process to really get what the composer wanted onto the page before the stuff was printed. So Beethoven's symphonies in these early editions are notorious for being just full of errors. So in the latter part of the 20th century, you had this big movement to editorialize these parts, the orchestra scores and the parts. And so then what you have is a publisher who hires editors and whatever, and they go back and study the manuscripts and do whatever it is that all these score editors are doing to prepare these editions. And then you have to purchase that edition, so the cost is higher. But there's still no recording restriction or anything like that involved. There's just a higher cost to get the music than free, for example, which you can do at IMSLP. Then when you move into copyright-protected music, then you're dealing with some agent of, you know, the copyright owner. So it's a publisher or, you know, whatever arrangement exists there. And in those cases, there's almost always a specific set of language as to, you know, here's what you hire this music for a certain amount, and here's what you get to do with it. And it's very clear what you're allowed to do based on those agreements.
So the ones that you mark are the ones that are where even the sheet music is in the public domain or has been licensed in an open way.
Or even stuff that's in the under copyright, or even new music. Two good examples of that would be just what you mentioned earlier, a conductor's interpretation or a certain orchestra's interpretation of, let's say, West Side Story. You know, we do it differently than the next orchestra down the road, and we do it, I mean, we do it differently than Leonard Bernstein conducted it. So, you know, that's kind of part of the process. So we might get the parts from his publishers, Boosey and Hawkes. We might get the parts in the score, and I would already have prepared my notes, you know, in terms of tempo, how fast we're going to do things, and may put in some other adjustments and specific indications for players. We go ahead and mark it up, and then usually the publishers just stipulate you erase those markings after the program.
Oh.
So we'll do that. And in the case of a new piece, very frequently, those pieces are very dynamic. They're changing. A composer hears it the first time, and they're like, overall, I like it, but I want to change some things. And we'll often focus on second and third and fourth performances of pieces because there aren't enough of those. And that's kind of area where we kind of dig in. And very often, we get what really is the final version of the piece when we perform it. And that actually contributes to whether or not the composer wants to share the work, because I've worked with a lot of composers. On the first couple of performances, they do not want that shared because they're still working it out, you know, and you know, until you're a very mature composer, you still need that feedback of the orchestra to really get your work perfect. And so, when you're the third or fourth orchestra and they've kind of settled in and they know what works and they can answer all the questions, then often like, hey, that was the performance I've been looking for. Let's put that one out there. So there's even an advantage to doing that, performing newer works, kind of not the flashy premiere, but the third or fourth time, because you can really get in on the point at which the work really enters the repertoire or enters the, you know, the culture at large. So, yeah, all kinds of stuff happens with music, just depending on the situation, and usually it's pretty cut and dry what you can do with different kinds of music.
Well, and before you said that, sometimes you'll get one and it's a horrible version of it, or, you know, a horrible edit of it. Have you ever gotten one where you really just wanted to play it, but it was, you could only get a really bad version of it, and you were just like, screw it, we'll just build off of this one, and kind of reworked it?
Yeah, it definitely happens.
Yeah.
Less and less, you know, as better and better editions come out, but definitely that happens. And what saves you in most respects, and this is something that's I think pretty unique to classical musicians, maybe even more so than jazz musicians, and certainly most other styles, is, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about where this music has come from historically, and you kind of use that to inform a particular way of playing it. So you would never walk into a first rehearsal of a Mahler symphony and play it the same way as you would a first rehearsal of a Bach cantata. Mm-hmm. You know, the Mahler is very romantic, very expressive, you know, more heavy-handed music, very grand. The Bach is more graceful, lighter. So you bring a different style, depending on what you're doing with the music and when the composer was alive and what they were writing for and all that, that kind of stuff. And so you may get a really horrible edition of some, you know, obscure English composer who lived during the time of Bach, but you already know so much about the style of that time that you can kind of filter out a lot of the garbage in, and almost like play it from the notes alone and still give it a lot of style, you know, and you're not as much worried about, oh, are the dynamic indications wrong or, you know, are the tempos wrong? As long as the notes are basically there, most orchestras can bring some style to it, even if it's a really terrible addition. So, yeah, there's a lot that goes on that side of this that people may not think of when they consider how does this music eventually make its way on stage and onto, you know, into digital recordings and out on the web. It's all a huge part of it.
Ruben, what about the playing this stuff live over the internet or streaming like Doug was asking about?
Well, definitely that's something that's going to be a feature of what we do here at WCF Symphony. And actually, we do it now on occasion. We have a concert coming up next week. And this concert is going to be broadcast live by Iowa Public Radio, which also streams, obviously, on the web. So by its very nature, this broadcast is going to be live streamed and live broadcast. And we've done that before with special programs. I think we're going to start moving towards a point where we do that with every single concert we do, probably through our own hosted we'll host our own stream on our website or something instead of doing it all with Iowa Public Radio. They have a program featuring our concerts, but it's kind of produced with interviews and stuff like that. So those air afterwards. I think we'll move towards that. And in fact, what we'll probably do is we'll be okay to perform a lot of public domain music, and I'm sure almost all of the contemporary music we do will be covered. You know, we'll be able to stream that live. And then what we'll do subsequent to the concerts is I think we'll start posting almost all of the public domain recordings or the ones where we feel like the performance quality was high enough. Those will all go online. And, you know, for example, the copyright stuff, that wouldn't go online for subsequent listening.
Right.
So that's probably the direction we're heading.
And then now what really, I mean, how did you discover Creative Commons and what made you go, yeah, I want to use that?
That's a good question. I think it was just through using these cool services. You know, if you're a Vimeo user or a SoundCloud user, if you've had any interest in sharing media on the internet, you end up using some of these platforms. And I think to me, in a lot of cases, the platforms sort of introduced me on a basic level to the fact that this existed and what it was. And then, of course, you know, I've been very interested in this, and as a pretty active blogger, you know, it's talked about if you're in the music business at all, you know, and you follow people who blog in music, you know, it comes up and there are really substantive discussions online about all kinds of aspects of copyright and Creative Commons in particular. So it kind of snowballed for me, but I'm sure I just first became more aware of it as I first got more into sharing media. And now it seems like that seems like a prehistoric era. It was probably, you know, 5 years ago or something.
Right. Yeah, we've discussed that. Like, it does seem like it was forever ago. But, like, yeah, I mean, I think I discovered it back in, like, 2006 or something, you know, and that wasn't that long ago. But it feels like it was forever ago. But
very true.
And on the profile on the WFC Symphony, on the profile on the site that you're on, Jesus, I'm just not going to be able to say it. At the end of it, it says you are the most followed classical Tumblr's most followed classical music site on
I
there.
Think so.
Now, is yeah, it because so. Are you the only classical music guy on Tumblr? I find it hard to believe that there are a lot of classical people on Tumblr.
That's a really good question. you know, the Tumblr thing has been a very interesting experience for me. Right now, I have about 170,000 followers on Tumblr. Which I think is pretty sizable across the entire platform, not just for musicians, but I was also promoted by them, and I think I was one of the very earliest classical musicians to use the site, and that's why they promoted me. I think before the current phase at Tumblr, they were, you know, they've always really kind of been about their creators who use their service, and so they had picked, you know, an interesting set of blogs and really push those through the dashboard and on their spotlight pages and stuff. And this is before, you know, you have your New York Philharmonic on Tumblr type stuff. I mean, now at this point, I think most organizations that have a reasonable social media effort, you know, have a Tumblr going. So you have hundreds, if not thousands, of classical music organizations using Tumblr, as well as all the other social media services. But the reason I was there was because I thought it was, at that time, and still believe it is, a good place for creative folks.
Yeah.
And because I was a pretty early adopter, I think, reasonably early, I think even maybe the guy who founded Tumblr might have come across my site, and that might be how they ended up promoting me through those channels. So it was great. And the interesting thing about it, it's really opened my eyes. I mean, I've learned a lot about social media dynamics just in general through the Tumblr experience. But one of the remarkable things is how many of my followers are young and international, like definitely not, it's really not confined at all in any way. It is sort of Anglo/European, which is what you typically associate with classical music in terms of, you know, where the heritage of that tradition lies. And it's really remarkable. I mean, I wouldn't have thought if you put in front of, you know, some random kid in the Philippines, like, oh, hey, here's this conductor on Tumblr, that they would click that follow button, you know. But that's what has happened. And it's, you know, I would love to get even more metrics on who my followers are. And maybe that'll come eventually from Tumblr. But
right.
But it's been fascinating to watch that. And it's really made me believe deeply that the music we do is definitely, definitely not only for, you know, the so-called symphony crowd, that sort of older crowd, a retirement right. community crowd type thing. But that's, people trot that out so often.
Yeah.
When talking about orchestras. And I think it's just like, you know, you may be on that planet, but here on this planet, it's not where, you know, what I'm seeing. And yeah, so that's been a whole interesting experience for me. And I think it's something I'm probably going to, I hope to work with them maybe on a couple projects. We'll see if it ever happens.
Yeah, like the thing you're talking about before is just, I just did a quick example. Like the old lady with the pearls and the glasses on the handle from like the Marx Brothers movies, where, you know, you come in and you play something that's not classical and she'll be like, oh, and fall over. Yeah. That's essentially what I picture when you were saying the stereotypical sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, we shouldn't forget. I mean, we, you know, a lot of times people like me can overstate their, you know, their adventurousness and say, look at how cutting edge we are. I mean, Mahler, you know, Mahler's first symphony has this last movement starts with an insane cymbal crash, huge chord in the orchestra, and it comes out of this really quiet, beautiful closure to the previous section. And he stated that his goal, actually, he wanted to scare the little old ladies, and he wanted to, you know, hear them drop their purses at the beginning of the fourth movement of this piece. Nice. And that was, you know, that was like 120 years ago, 130 years ago. So
right.
Nothing vanguard about that. It's, you know, there's always been an element of classical music that's quote unquote more mature.
Yeah.
But I think it's a joke to point to that and say that's all we have.
Well, it's the entire plot of the movie Amadeus. So
hey, it makes for good entertainment, clearly.
It does. All right, now you were going to say, Doug?
we don't have time for to get into a geopolitical discussion, as I'm sure I would be interested in. Tom wouldn't. Yes, I was, you know. but I would like to point out.
Let you guys fight that one out.
Yeah, I would like to point out that the Philippines was Spanish at one point and then American at another point. So we're not completely outside of the European tradition there.
Yeah. No, but I mean, you know, I'm always stunned when I click through some of these followers, you know, just sort of at random, just to see who they are. And I'm seeing 10, 15, 20 different languages on these blogs, you know, on the little descriptions. And, you know, kids who are 15, 16, 17, who for whatever reason just thought, hey, it's cool that this conductor is like sharing fun stuff here on Tumblr. I'm going to follow this blog.
Right.
And it just makes me think that, you know, where people might say, oh yeah, a kid from one of those cultures is going to open up a website and see a white conductor, you know, who's really good at conducting Mahler or something. And I'm into this, you know, that it seems far-fetched that people often, you know, claim that that's where our problem is. And I don't think that's where the problem is with classical music. I think we haven't allowed all of these people who have an interest in what we do, we haven't allowed them to have the kind of access that they would like. That's what our problem is. It's not that people don't like it. It's that we've cut off the access. So this whole Creative Commons discussion is so much about that. not even just the access, but about the engagement, you know, the opportunity to connect with people. That's why I'm a big believer in it. So, yeah, I mean, it kind of circles around.
And speaking of that, huh? How's this for a segue? When we get down to the end of the interview, we like to ask these questions, these last two questions here, as a way to kind of meet more people in the Creative Commons community. And one of them is, who are some people you think we should try to get on the show who are in the Creative Commons music community today? And I've seen on your, you know, your profile here that you've worked with Calexico, so feel free to throw their name out there.
Yeah, hey. Well, I would say get in touch with those guys. They're actually very cool and an incredible group of musicians. Yeah. And I don't know what their situation is like these days with record labels and stuff, but I am hoping to work with them again with orchestra at some point. And I think they're just amazing guys. It was great to do the, we did kind of a half concert together. It was a lot of fun.
Cool.
Well, there's a really interesting colleague of mine. He's not a conductor, but he's actually a radio host and program director over at Public Media in Louisville, Kentucky. He was previously the director of Minnesota Public Radio Classical, and now he's from Louisville, and he's back there now. His name is Daniel Gilliam, and he's also a composer. So he's someone who's really interesting in terms of his connection with media and also, you know, as a creator. I mean, really as an artist himself, is someone I think who's got some really good thoughts about digital media and just media in general. And I think at least is someone who's really very much a Creative Commons type person. But he'd be very cool to talk to. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, if you kind of, sometimes I'll be like, who have I worked with recently? And I'll go check out, you know, just run through the list of recent concerts or the list of people who have been on board. But I will say there's kind of a trend I notice. A lot of the artists I work with personally in classical music who may not, let's say, be represented by an agent or by a record label tend to be interesting people to talk with about this stuff. We just worked with a pianist who's from Iowa, actually. His name is Connor Hannock.
Hmm.
He plays a lot of new music, like really crazy, awesome, challenging, gnarly, great piano music of the present day, you know, like stuff that's being written right now and recently. We did a John Adams piece together. It was fabulous. But you know, somebody like him might be interesting to talk to from the perspective of the performer and also, you know, someone who works so closely with composers and, you know, probably is constantly at the center of that discussion of like, you know, we want our work to mean more to audiences. How can we get it out there? How can we get people to interact with this work? And so that'd be an interesting person to talk to. I think a lot of the other, some of the other artists I've worked with, you might have to jump through a couple hoops to get a hold of these people.
Normally, we're not good at jumping through hoops.
Yeah, there are some interesting names out there. One musician I worked with who's incredible, and I don't know where he would really fall into this discussion, but I know that his manager and the people he works with are generally much more progressive than the typical classical music crowd. His name is Matt Heimovitz. He's a cellist. He actually blew up huge as a young man, like biggest you could possibly be in the classical world when he was like 16, 17. But then kind of walked away from it for a while and went to school and came out of it and pioneered this amazing project where he took the Bach cello suites and played them in bars and nightclubs all around the country.
Oh, cool.
And he was like the first classical dude to try that and has since done a lot of interesting things. But you might be able to get a hold of Matt if you look him up and go through his people. They might hook you up with him and chat a little bit. He's an amazing guy and really worth looking at. Anybody who's interested in what's going on out there in music these days.
He's not the guy that just got featured recently on SoundCloud, is he?
He might have been. I know he was featured. He had a nice NPR feature recently.
That's what it was. It was on NPR. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. That's him. Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool.
He's awesome and very worth talking to probably about any subject because he's just been in and out of the music industry in the most intense way you possibly can.
Uh-huh.
So he's been around it all, and I think he's got a great point of view at this point in his career.
And by the way, when I say I saw that, I mean on the website. It's not that I listen to NPR and I see colors. So
it's okay too.
I just realized that.
Always encourage, you know, we do our youth concerts. We tell the kids, look, you know, listen for the colors that you see while you hear. That's what we're all about.
And then the last question we like to ask is, while we talked with you this whole time, is there anything that we didn't cover or something that you'd like to tell the people about that maybe we weren't aware of?
Well, you know, I would say this, which is really heartening to me. It's right now is really pretty remarkable time, and it's not clear how things will unfold in the future. But if you're interested in music right now, at your fingertips is more information, more access to music than I think ever, and to different kinds of music that, you know, many people in the past have been marginalized from, you know, and I think that goes both ways. I mean, you can have more folk traditions that have almost been invisible that are now becoming much more prominent and becoming much more part of mainstream culture, and then you have kind of quote unquote high culture that, you know, so many people have really not been able to access over the generations. And on both sides, there's this incredible, you know, mingling and this huge mashup of information that's out there, which makes this an amazing time for just discovery. You know, I think that's part of what Creative Commons is about for me, is also just about discovery, you know, and the sense that like some of the sites where we've shared our music, I feel like these are great places where people come to discover more about music without some of the preconceptions that they may have when they turn on the radio or walk into a concert hall or do, let's say, 20th century musical activities, right? Mm-hmm. So, I think something I always share with our audiences, but just with the general music aficionado is such a great time. And there's so much amazing stuff out there. And I think it's really liberating that it's no longer about that one definitive version of something, but it's all about, you know, the incredible diversity that's out there and the individual type voices that are reaching bigger audiences. And I think it's just very exciting. I take the opposite view of many in the music business and especially in the orchestra business, the sort of doom and gloom. I think there's huge opportunity out there, and our mainstay hasn't gone away yet. We still perform and do well at that, and audiences still come. So we have the best of the old, and we have this huge opportunity in front of us. And yeah, we'll see what happens.
Nice. And Doug, did you have anything you'd like to add before we wrap up today?
No, it's been great. I think we easily could have gone another hour, but no one wants to do that tonight. So maybe some other time.
And
dude, I think I got a Laker game on here. We're hoping for a better season this year, so I might have to for that.
And Doug, is he the first conductor we've had on the show?
So
I
yes want to
say
no.
Yes.
No, well, we've had my dad on, and he's
yeah, but
a
I don't count that. That's your dad.
Yeah, nah. We talked about electronic music mostly. So my dad used to program music in Fortran when he was in university.
Oh, cool!
Before nice. I was alive, so
nice. Well, no, I'll gladly defer and be the second. But yeah, maybe you guys should get like a maestro bell or something for any other time, Dr. Ron.
But this is definitely the first time that we've talked about the inner workings of orchestra. So yeah, right. I mean.
Okay, I just wanted to double check because sometimes I'll make those assumptions and then Doug will post like 5 shows that we've already done it on and I'm like, God damn it. All right, well, Jason, thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Hey, guys, thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure to be with you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. And this has been another Music Manuet podcast at musicmanuet.com.